Did you know Pete Waterman had 22 number one singles during his career? He's the man who founded Kylie Minogue. He found Rick Astley. He found Bananarama. And he made a massive name within music and within business from right here in the Northwest. Of course, we know him from Stock Aitken and Waterman fame, presenting TV shows like The Hitman and Her, presenting on the radio here in Liverpool in Radio City, and now creating a brand new smash hit musical. I couldn't wait to chat to Pete over Zoom and just find out about his incredible journey, his amazing career, when he first realised that he had something special to start producing all of these hit singles, and to get some advice for you as well, whether you want to make it in music or just in business. He says something really poignant in this interview about how anyone can make it. It's a great, great chat. Me and Pete Waterman, we all know him. What a legend, music mogul, TV star, and TV judge. This is Nailing It with me, Jay Hind, and the legend that is Pete Waterman. Hello, how are you?
I'm marvellous, thank you. I've just walked outside. Somebody knocked the door. I got drowned. It's like throwing it down here in Runcorn.
It's horrible at the moment, isn't it? But things will brighten up next week, mate, in Liverpool, because the show lands at Liverpool Empire. It must be great to see. Kind of Liverpool is kind of your hometown. You know, it must be great to see it arrive here.
Yeah, I'm very lucky in that, you know, I moved here in the early 80s, and, you know, I've lived up here longer now than I lived in the Midlands. Any man that can count two places at home is a lucky man. I love it up here, and, you know, I was in Birmingham last week, which, of course, I was born in Coventry, so to go to Birmingham with everything that's got going on in Birmingham was a treat. But without a doubt, the best audience will be in Liverpool because, you know, they know why the songs were written. They were part of why they were written. They were part of the whole Stock Aitken Waterman community because I was, as you said, on Radio City every Saturday and we did gigs all around, you know, Liverpool and obviously the Hitman and Her. So, you know, if you were in the 80s and you were in the Northwest, you were part of that whole culture.
We got to say as well, you mentioned the 80s there. A lot of these songs, 22 UK number one hit singles, they still transcend today. You know, I know young people who know the songs, know every single word. And I'm not just talking the I Should Be So Lucky's. That whole back catalogue, it still sounds great in this day and age, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's very difficult to sort of say why. But if you look at the fact that you're on a radio station, in a place like Liverpool, you're seeing the audience constantly and you are taking people from the Willows, from, you know, from Everton or wherever it is, and you are transposing them onto the national stage. Then the people around you see what you're doing and they get it. So it's, if you're in London, you don't get it, you don't see it. But if you're in the Northwest and you're listening, you get it because there's this guy on a radio station in Liverpool that's suddenly number one in the charts with all these records, and you're the first to hear them, you know, in your part of the world. And you feel almost as part of it as like when the Beatles broke back in the 60s, because you're in on the secret. You're in that little clique, that club that says, we know every Saturday morning Pete Waterman will play a brand new track that nobody else in the rest of the country does.
Well, how did you get into Radio City? Because at the time, you were a big star on TV. And Radio City, you know, it was a big station. I worked there for 15 years. It was a big, big station, but it was still a local station. What made you come back up and jump on the airwaves there?
Well, it's a very funny story. I was in a pub in Whitley, which is just down the road from Runcorn. And I'd literally gone to this pub for dinner with my girlfriend. And in my pocket, I'd got, this is the old days when you had cassettes. I had a cassette of the Rick Astley album, which I'd just finished like 2 days before. Nobody'd ever heard it. Never going to give you up a bin hit. So I said to the landlord, could you put this on? I'd like to listen to it, you know, just like see if there was any reaction. And I put it on, and a guy came over to me and he said, "You're Pete Waterman, that's Rick Astley. Is that the Rick Astley album?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm Tony Ingham. I'm the program director at Radio City, and I think you want to be a DJ." I said, "Well, that's what I am." He says, "Well, why don't you come work for Radio City?" And the rest is history. That's how it started.
Wow. And then you were down on Stanley Street in the little studio down there. Making some great, great shows.
Well, what was interesting was Tony, as I say, was in this pub. I played these tracks, and Tony instantly picked up the hits off the album that went on to be hits. So he sort of went, he could see as a program director what I was doing was fitting into his program. He just went, "This is Radio City, I've got it. This guy will fit in perfectly." And it was him, by the way, that gave me the name The Hitman.
Okay, so that's where that started.
There was a guy called Radio City.
Terry Smith, who was the old, I think he was the founder of Radio City. He's not longer with us.
Yeah, he was the founder. Terry was, I mean, you know, Terry, we did some amazing things together, Terry and I. I mean, you know, because Terry, you know, was a director at Liverpool, and, you know, it's a small community. And I guess that what we were doing in hindsight now, it's really interesting, you know, with this town on BBC One at the minute, because I was part of the whole two-term thing. But you now look at this, and you mentioned Terry Smith, and you look at what Liverpool was like at this point, along with the football club and everything that was happening. Very similar to what that was. I had sort of moved to the Northwest, and sort of that had come with me, where I didn't have that, you know, obviously when I was in the Midlands, I was a ballroom DJ, a club DJ. When I moved to the Northwest, I've become a radio DJ, television DJ. So the power has gone up by about fivefold. Radio City was very important. They were very, very forward-thinking, as was Granada at the time. Terry got complaints about me in the first 3 weeks from two of the big advertisers who didn't like the fact of the music I was playing. And Terry was brave enough to say, and they were massive, massive local advertisers, "You'll have to withdraw your advertising." I thought that was amazing. And he came to me and said, "Don't you change. You play these records to kids. I've put you on from 9 till 12, particularly for this audience." And he said, "You know, people will, mums and dads will take their kids out in the car going shopping. The kids can sit in the car and listen to the music while they do shopping. That's the audience I want. That's a Saturday morning audience. If the advertisers don't want that, then they're not for my station.
And so be it."
It was really interesting. And of course, you know, you've got lots of young kids used to come in. We had the phones manned, my kids, you know. They just come in and we put them on. It was like a big youth club. It was Terry Smith's youth club. That's the only way to describe it, you know. And we were doing daft things. I mean, I flew back because I was doing a lot in Japan. I mean, we were so busy at the time. My God, I never missed a Saturday morning Radio City. So I go to Japan on the Monday. And I would have to be back in the UK late Friday night, very early Saturday morning. And I'd get the plane up to Manchester and I'd get picked up and taken to the city. And I was flying out, and it was just before Christmas. So it was late October, early November. And they had to divert the plane via Anchorage. And they couldn't land the plane for an hour because there were polar bears on the runway. So literally, when I landed, I got into Radio City and they'd been playing the theme tune for about 4 minutes because I wasn't actually there. And I got in with a breathless, you know, and I opened the mic and said, "Oh, I'm really sorry, a bit late." But I couldn't land because there were polar bears on the runway. Of course, everybody's falling about laughing. And sort of, so we came up with this idea of, I went and bought two giant stuffed polar bears from Hamleys in London. And this, the idea was when we take them into Liverpool and we put them in two shops and we open them up and we said, listen, somewhere in Liverpool, shops in Liverpool has got two polar bears. If you find those two polar bears, you can come on the show and we give you a present for Christmas. Well, we got caught within about 5 minutes from the police. Could you stop this? There's riots going on. And that's what we were doing. It was fantastic. You know, the police on the phone, Pete, stop doing this. There's kids rampage in the middle of Liverpool.
Love it.
You can't, you know, it's like, that's what Terry Smith and Tony did. You know, that, you know, it was mind blowing. It was rock and roll radio. It really was, you know, you read story about Alan Freed. And that's what it was like. It was like Tony would ring me up and say, you know, rip their heads off. And I remember playing Kylie Minogue, one of the new singles, first on a Saturday morning. And Tony, who always listened to the show, rang me and he said, give Radio 1's number out and say to the audience, ring this number and ask them why they're not playing the new Kylie single and only Radio City is, right? Well, the BBC went berserk. Wow. I mean, nuts. We got letters of complaints. Terry Smith was like pulled in front of the IBA. It was like, we just couldn't believe it. But the BBC, I mean, the BBC actually threatened to ban the Kylie records because we'd given their number out on the phone.
It's great to hear, Pete, as a former Radio City employee. It's great to hear these stories because you're right, it was kind of rock and roll back in the day, and it's changed so much now, hasn't it, radio? It's not like what it was. You can't get away with things like that anymore. And music's kind of the same as well, isn't it? Things have changed so dramatically.
Well, you can't get away with it now because you know what? They don't want to get away with it. Music has become fodder. You know, it's become streaming. Don't upset anybody. Don't rock the boat. What I find it interesting, because, you know, we've been doing a lot of research with the musical. The average attention span of a youngster right now, according to the streamers, is like 35 seconds.
Wow.
And they like, I said, well, I've got to tell you, my attention span is like 6.5 seconds. Because if you ain't got me with the first chorus, you ain't getting me any further. So, you know, what you're telling me is that you've got like millions of Pete Watermans out there who think the music you're playing is crap. 15 million hits. I don't care whether we've got 20 million hits. It's either good or it ain't good.
Yeah.
And this whole concept that we now have on these some of these big radio stations where they play eight records. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to hear Kylie eight times, even if I owned it. You know, it's like, oh, hang on a minute. I don't want just entertaining. I want a bit of it. You know, I want entertainment, but I also want a bit of education. I want to hear stuff that I'm not going to hear normally, that I could hear, and you'll go, oh, I like that, because that's how we all learned. You know, that's how we all love music, because somebody played you something, you go, oh, I really like that. You didn't, you know, there's no ether out there where suddenly all this mind comes in. You know, you've heard it somewhere. Somebody's recommended it, you know.
You're talking the same words that many of us from the radio industry talk today, Pete, and it's so, so true. Listen, I could talk to you about radio all day. I want to talk to you about kind of business and when you started to realise it that you were nailing it in your profession. Was there a moment that you thought, my God, this is taking off, I could do really well out of this? And what was that moment for you?
Oh, yeah, I could tell you exactly what that moment was. It was when Ghost Town went to number one and I was in my Ford Fiesta delivering records to a record shop. And I was on the way back from somewhere like Surrey in the car and I was listening to, you know, the radio. And the specials were on Top of the Pops at number one, and there was I still delivering records. And I thought, hang on a minute here, I've got all this bloody wrong. You know, I've created this, and I'm still delivering records. Whoa, I'm not doing this anymore. You know, I'm not going to listen to other people. You know, which is like, I couldn't get the specials arrested, and I tried everywhere. You know, and at the time I was hot and couldn't get them arrested. So I thought, that's it. Enough, I'm going to do it myself. And if I fail, I fail. But I'm not going to tell people about stuff and then not benefit when it happens. So if I see something, I'll back it. If it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, I'll know that I haven't got the ears I thought I'd have, and I won't be able to do it for more than a year. So I gave myself basically a year to make it. I sort of said, right, I'm going to live on, and this is true. I mean, I worked out I could live on £45 a week when I've been living on sort of £6,000 a year, which is 120 quid a week. I'd got my lifestyle down that I could live on £35 a week. And that was my whole, and that included my train fare, by the way. That was how I sort of said, that's my 35 quid. Anything above that, I'll plow back into my business. And at the end of the day, as long as I come to the end of the year and I'm not too far away from the 35 quid, I know I wouldn't be, I'd be in the red at the bank by a small amount. And I've been successful and I can view the next year. Well, of course, that didn't happen, but it gets close. But it was that point when I said, I'm not going to just work for other people. I'm going to do this for myself.
And did you get that first then, I presume? When you got that number one, I presume you just thought, it must be such a buzz to get a number one, because there's no greater accolade in music, is there? I suppose then you're hungry for more because you've felt that feeling. It's a bit addictive.
To be honest, I think that, we were facing at that point such adversity. We were being criticised so bad. I mean, we cut off from the rest of the record industry. We had to. We couldn't take the abuse. I mean, it was like we'd drawn the shutters down. We were in the bunker. And so I remember that, that first number one, the first top four, five was Hazel Dean, which was amazing. I mean, amazing, because we were paying the bills with credit cards, and we were paying one credit card off with another credit card. It really was that scary. So I think we were elated that we were doing it, but the pressures of actually paying the bills at the end of the month were so enormous that it sort of, that was the prize, that we paid the bills at the end of the month, not it was number three in the charts or number four.
It was surviving.
We'd survive, yeah. And we could afford another piece of equipment, or we could afford to take on another member of staff. So that was, in truth, what it was like. We only ever celebrated once. We only ever celebrated once in all the time that I remember having number ones. When Venus went to number one in America, we had a party in the street for all the neighbours. I mean, that was literally the only time we ever celebrated.
Do you know everything you're saying now? I know we spoke about music and radio and things changing so much, from then to now. Everything you're saying there, though, is still very true, isn't it? It's being cautious all the time. Again, not celebrating, not being too kind of proud of yourself. And you've still got to put the work in, haven't you? And that transcends to any business, to anyone who wants to do well in this day and age as well.
Oh, without a question, I think that, if you don't, it's not about, let's get one thing on the table. It's not about money. If it's about money, don't go into business.
Yeah.
If you're into business, be a crook. Be a criminal. Because it's easier to make money that way, by nicking stuff, than it is to work and to do it. And that's why so many people do it that way. If you want to build a business, then it's hard work. You've got to really believe in your product. And you've got to convince other people that your product is worth them. But more important, you've got to know when you're wrong and back off quick. And so you can't believe your own hype. So you may be a great salesman and give it all beans, but when you put that phone down, you've got to remember you've just sold your life, and you better make sure that it works. Because if it doesn't, you'll never get that sale again. So, you've got to... you've got to be humble, and you've got to be, I always knew that when we sent records to stores, they all knew that they would sell a certain amount of copies. They were confident. And if we wanted, you know, an extra push, because we needed to get an artist like Rick Astley, we knew you could ring and say, do you need some more records? And they would buy more records. And at the end of the day, your product has to be in the shop for you to have a hit. If it wasn't there for people to buy, and people like Record Merchandiser, which were Woolworths, were very incredibly hard to deal with. But the buyer at Woolworths used to trust me. So they rang him and say, will you take 50,000? Which is like, will you give me 20 grand? I knew he would do it if I rang him, because he knew I wouldn't ring him if I didn't think he was going to sell them. So where I was boosting his position, I was also boosting our position in that those records for that week after Top of the Pops, there would be huge amounts of stock in Woolworths when the kids went in after Top of the Pops, which meant that we got a catapult. You know, it was like winding it up. Friday morning into Woolworths, there were lots of stock, which meant it would catapult out Friday and Saturday, which meant we'd always be in the top three.
It's so interesting hearing you talk like this, because obviously I've followed your career with you being on TV for so many years and radio and as a personality. But when you see the businessman, you're kind of like, wow, what do you prefer? Do you prefer the businessman, Pete Waterman, or do you prefer the TV radio personality?
Oh, I'm only a team leader. You know, that's what I am. That I build great teams in my career. That's what I do. If you look at all around, you know, PWL, Stock Aitken Waterman, or all the other things I did, it's because they're teams. I put teams together. You know, I love to see people reach their full potential. You know, that's my talent, is to spot somebody with real talent and go, well, you're not focused enough. Why don't you focus around here? And you know, whether it be on Pop Idol or whatever, just go, right, focus, here's where we do it. And Simon Cowell's a classic example of somebody I met and went, oh, this kid's got it. He needs focusing. You ain't going to change his ways, but, you know, just focus in there. Because I never wanted to be Simon. I never wanted to do what Simon's done or his lifestyle. It's never been interesting to me. But, you know, you watch that and you go, he's a guy that can take on the world. And he did take on the world.
He did.
You know, so I stand back and go, I was right again. And this time he's still my best mate.
Listen, we're going to talk about the stage show, the musical, in just a second, a bit more detail. Just finally, in terms of that business, you were saying then about having it and not having it. Again, that transcends into any field, doesn't it? What is it? What would you describe it as? If there's an 18-year-old listening right now who wants to succeed in music or become a producer or open a florist, whatever it might be, what would you say that they need?
Intuition. It's intuition. At the end of the day, you know, and this, okay, we live in a different world to when I started my business back in the late 60s. I couldn't read or write, okay? I couldn't read or write till I was 30, okay? So I even had to take my checks into the bank to get the tiller, you know, the teller, to actually write the amount out and I would sign, because I couldn't write the word 1,000. Certainly couldn't write 3,000, but I was with an Irish bank, so to put 3,000, they were quite used to that, right? So you can't be shy about that. You've got to be honest. And they all know, and they say, right, well, you know, you'll come in and you'll be writing a check for 100 grand. I bought a Ferrari, for instance. I took my bank manager to the dealership with me because he couldn't believe I was buying the Ferrari. But that was the relationship you had. But it's instinct. You need that instinct. You need to know that you won't let anybody down. That's the problem. With modern education today, what we do is, and you need education. You can't any longer do what I did. You need to be able to work computers. You need to be able to read because of all of the instructions. But you also need an intuition that we're not being taught, you know. This is not a tick box exercise. There is no GCSEs in common sense. You know, there is no MVQs means not very qualified. Because if you're qualified, you've got a job. Because everybody will employ somebody that can do something well. So having a certificate isn't the answer. It's having the passion and the knowledge to do the job. And to do that, you've got to do the job to get the experience. And never, ever in my life did I ever put the money important to the learning. To me, I would do a job and lose money if I was learning something. So, you know, I accepted DJ jobs in clubs that were important clubs, not because I wanted to be in that club, but that club was influential and I knew it would take me to the next stage. I would do it for less than because of, you know, a limited contract, but I'd do it if I thought I could walk away at the end of the day with that CV, but it had taught me something. Then it's like, I'm paying for this. And that's my apprenticeship. I'm paying to learn this. And everybody goes to university, and I have nothing against education, please. I've got my grandchildren are fantastic. I'm amazed at the way my four-year-old grandson can read all the railway nameplates. It's amazing to see that. But you mustn't lose the reality of it. Nothing substitutes for experience. And everybody has that. There is nobody ever out there that doesn't have instinct, because you're born with it. It's whether you use it or whether you... It's what the education authorities do now is you tick a box. I mean, I was invited to do courses at a well-known Northwest University, and at the end of the day refused because they couldn't fail. Because as the dean said to me, if they fail, we don't get paid. Sorry, if they're not very good, they shouldn't be getting the... Yeah, but we can't fail them because we're getting the money from the government. What sort of education is that? That sends the wrong message. If I fail as a record producer, it's cost me £5,500. You know what? You don't need too many failures because it soon racks up and your bank balance goes like that. You go, oh, I ain't doing one of them again.
And, you know what?
So it's instinct.
Yeah, instinct. Yeah. Out of every question I've asked everyone on this podcast, that's probably the best answer. Because it's simple stuff, isn't it? It's not rocket science.
It is.
Get the experience. It is. Brain, use your head.
Look at business from the beginning. Go back 200 years, right? Every great business has a simple, simple start, okay? It's supply and demand, okay? So now we have influencers and all, it's all nonsense because you've got to take out the rhetoric. So influencers, somebody at the back, ground going, I can make a few bob here, but I'll get this kid 90 cents for makeup and we'll sell it at $90, limited to 1 million copies because you've got 20 million followers. I'm not daft. I know what's going on. And everybody else does, right? And everybody wants to be an influencer. But nobody's looked at this and gone, actually, there's somebody in the background here making a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's like the whole industry when people used to say about your mobile phone is free. Well, of course it's not free. You pay for it. Of course, mobile phones are not free. You pay for it. Your computer's not free. I mean, you know, the price of computers now is fortunes. So it's just being streetwise, yeah. You know. It's like, if you know, I started off by selling jammy Dodgers at school, you know. I bought a packet of jammy Dodgers and I charged a penny because all the kids wanted something at playtime. Well, I've got two packets of jammy Dodgers. That's a quid. You know, that's a bob. And I had pieces of toast my mum had made in the morning. I sold those for like 1 threepence. And you know, you walk away with two bob in your pocket.
Simple stuff.
It's simple. Yeah. It's simple. All the great businessmen, you know, look at it. It's very simple. They found a niche. What people like, they've not let them down. They can get totally criticised by their peers. You know, their stores are crap, all this and that. I mean, the Ratner story is the one. when you go and tell your public that the stuff they're buying is shit, you know you ain't got a business because you've just given the game away. You know, if that's a content you've got for your customers, you shouldn't be in business.
Yeah, completely agree. Absolutely. But I could chat to you all day, Pete, about this because you are giving some really, really valuable advice. We've got to talk about the show. It's coming to Liverpool. Yeah. Everyone's talking about this. Kylie is featured and all of those big hit singles from Stock Aitken and Waterman as well. Just tell us about your kind of journey with the show, because I presume you've been looking at doing this for a long time or approached by people for this for a long time.
I think I was 18 when it started. I've certainly felt like I used to feel 18. It's a very long journey. It never came together. We've had some famous writers on it, but it just didn't work. And then Debbie Izzet came to us via an agent, and she got this story. We met with her, and it sort of rang a bell. And we knew it was time. We knew because we were being pursued by television, particularly, to do the documentary we did. And it was like, well, hang on a minute here. Maybe this is the moment. Wasn't easy. It wasn't easy because the problem you have, and you know this as a radio DJ, people buy your records and that's the way they hear the record, okay? So when you do a musical, they don't want to do it like that. They want to do it in their own way. Well, from day one, you know, I told them, no, you can't do that because these are people's memories. The whole thing about when people come to see the show, they will want to hear the records the way that they remember them. And if you don't do that, I've let them down because I'm involved with the rehearsals and I've said it is fine for you to change the record. Now, there are two exceptions in the show to that rule. And I'm not a fool. If somebody changes it and it's fantastic, I'm not going to say, we can't do that. No. I'm going to say, oh, never saw that one. Fantastic. I mean, the Sonia song gets me every time. Completely different to what we did it. We could have never done it as a ballad because that's not what we did. So that's, you know, those have changed. But other songs, we had to insist that they came back to the way that they sounded, which was quite difficult in the early period with the musicians because they had this concept of what, you know, musical theatre is. And I'll give you, for instance, as a DJ, you'll really appreciate this. In the show, you soon get the joke, okay? So within about 10 minutes of the opening, you've got the joke.
Okay.
You're in. The audience are in. They're not daft. They've got it. So the dialogue is leading you to the next song, okay? So everybody in the audience is trying to work out different characters where the songs are going, right?
I'm going to enjoy doing that.
Right. So, and I'm not going to, I won't spoil the plot, but there is, as a DJ, if you come on the air, you come out the news, you hit the audience with your strongest song, and off you go. And then you slow it down to a mood in the middle, and then you end on a crescendo. Not musical theatre, right? So I sat with the director, with the producer, and I said, whoa, why are you different from anybody else? Why, all the things I'm involved with, television, radio, DJing, ballrooms, clubs, this is the rule. You have a different rule. So you build the audience up and then you don't deliver. No, well, we deliver at the end, but that's an hour later. So you're coming down. Everybody knows when two actors come on the stage, so it's near the end of the first half, and when the actor stands up and looks at the audience and says, we're no strangers to love, they all know what bloody song's coming next. And the whole audience jump up and say, we know the rules, and so do I. You've closed the curtain on them. So they're all sitting there going, what? You can't do that. You've got to give them Rick Astley. And they go, no. So we've been on the road since November.
Yeah.
They've just come to the conclusion that Rick Astley should be in the first half of the show. And it's like, you go, oh, what is going on here? But it's once they come back from the interval, the second half is just wild. And the end of the show, the theatre's just nuts. I mean, we've had fabulous fights. We've had all sorts of... I mean, it's a typical wedding, you know. Too many people get drunk and too many people say the wrong things. But people go out at the end and say, Pete, this is fantastic. You know, with everything that's going on in the world today, I needed this 2 hours. I've come out of it. I can't believe... You know, but there's a bit of fruity language in it. And there's a bit of very, you know, unpolitically correct jokes in this show. But that's what club life is like. That's what the 80s were all about. And there's one joke, and I'm not going to tell you the joke. That is, I go once a week at least to every theatre to watch the audience. I only go to watch the audience. I've seen the show 28 times or 30 times. The same joke at every theatre right across Great Britain has got the biggest roar of laughs and the biggest amount of applause, right? And so you go, the audience is no different. The audience, if they want a crack, when they hear the crack,
yeah,
they go off on one. It's totally politically incorrect to do.
Yeah.
Nobody goes, do you know what? That's outrageous, that. There's young kids in this audience, and they've just left them blind. The kids are the first to laugh. They get the joke straight away.
I think, luckily as well, things are changing back to the way they were, just slightly. I think we're losing some of that politically correctness gone mad kind of mentality at the moment, aren't we? So that'll be good to see and to watch on stage. I think the Scousers are going to love it probably more than other cities, Pete.
Oh, I think so.
Because we do love a good laugh and we love a good dance and a good sing song as well. For anyone that hasn't booked yet, why should they book their tickets?
Because for 2 hours they can lose themselves in fun and walk away feeling a lot better than they walked in.
Can't wait to see it. I should be so lucky. Liverpool Empire. One more question. You probably get asked this all the time, but I've got to ask you. One song left in your legacy out of your collection. What is that one song that sums up the life and journey of Pete Waterman?
I've never been asked that question.
Oh, really? I thought you would have been asked
that. I've never been asked that question. I've been asked for my favourite song, but never... Right, so... In a song, yeah, which is interesting because I put it in the show. I made sure it went in the show. And only the die-hard Stock Aitken Waterman fans ever pick it up. Right? One of the best friends that I work with, of all the artists I ever worked with, Donna Summer was a great friend and her husband. And it was very difficult to work with Donna because of her religious beliefs. But she was the best lyrically to give me ideas. So I'd known Donna and her husband for 20 years. And they were devoted to each other, devoted. And I thought, I'm going to put Donna in a situation where she falls in love with somebody else. How would she deal with it? Okay. And I think it sums my life up. And it's called In Another Place and Time.
And what a great song as well, Pete.
Well, things would be different. In another place and time. And is that not true of life? If only that had happened, things would be different. In another place and time.
Yeah. But you look back and I presume you are really happy with your career, with the success and the smiles that you bring in kids nowadays with the music that you've produced over the years and the things that you've done.
Listen, I've had an amazing life. I've probably done what most people would have taken five lifetimes to do. And that goes back to a question you asked me earlier. I've done what I wanted to do my way. I've never let anybody down. I've not cheated. If you didn't like it, that was fine by me. I didn't want you to like it if you didn't want it. But I've never, ever, ever not been true to myself. If I liked it, I believed it, I backed it. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. It cost me money. It didn't cost anybody else money.
Pete, you're a good
man. So I can stand up and go, you know what? I've done my best.
Yeah.
And when I meet, you know, the pearly gates, if I get up there, he's got to decide or they've got to decide which way I go. And I have no comprehension of what that is, but I've done the best I can.
I'm sure there's only one way you're going, mate. Listen, you're a good man. Thank you so much for chatting to us. Please get your tickets for this. I should be so lucky. Liverpool Empire, it's here next week. Pete Waterman, thank you so much, mate.
Bless you.